Welcome to another edition of Cambridge Inside Out. My name's Robert Winters.
And I'm Patrick Barrett.
This is not Judy Nathans. You may have noticed that. Judy's out this Tuesday, April 19th, which is also the day of the New York primary.
Oh, yes. I trust you're feeling the burn.
Never quite felt the burn. When I did feel the burn, I put a little salve on it.
I was fine.
Now, in addition to New York primaries and other things, there are some other things going on around town. The Cambridge Science Festival opened up this past weekend. Unfortunately, I didn't make it to the Science Carnival and Robot Zoo up at CRLS. I really tried to get there. It just was closing when I got there. It was terrible.
I absolutely love Cambridge. I got an email from a real estate agent this morning saying that she couldn't meet me earlier today because she was taking her son to the Robo Sale thing at MIT. Okay. And I was like, only in Cambridge would someone go to the Robo Sale event.
I feel somewhat privileged living in the city because we have all this, I'm a science kind of guy. And, just to have Harvard, MIT, not only to provide me a job, but also to have all these sort of interesting distractions all the time, it's really kind of cool.
It's allowed me, as a dullard, to be immersed in much more interesting people.
Ah, don't worry, young Jedi, we shall bring you along. So that was Science Festival. Now, there's still a few things going on with Science Festival this week. I'm not going to give you the whole list here because you'll just be hopelessly bored. But I'd say a couple of quick things.
Not like inclusionary zoning is going to be like, oh, my God, yeah, that's keep going, keep going.
Thoroughly exciting, right? The edge of your seat, inclusionary zoning. But one thing I was really pleased to see listed in the official program for Cambridge Science Festival, the Brattle Theater on Thursday night, 10 p.m. to 1:30 p.m. is playing Repo Man. Right? I don't know if I really think of it necessarily as science related, but...
Oh, it is. It is. But absolutely. It's my kind of science.
Such a great movie. If I wasn't... Actually, I teach until 9:30. I'm giving an exam, and I think they end right around 10. I could go run down the street and catch it. We'll see.
Be happy to meet you.
Yeah, so anyway, wonderful film. And the only other one I'm going to mention here, I mentioned it last week as well, is on Saturday, April 23rd, much of the day, 10 a.m. to 3 p.m., MIT, really, which is the ultimate carnival, science carnival, every day of the year, is having their sort of open house, sort of pretty much any place you want to go to at MIT. All day long. You just check it out online, but it's, if you know where MIT is, just look for the dome.
Dome shape and a robot.
Yeah, and you'll be fine. You'll be fine. So anyway, that's what's coming up around town here. It's also springtime, and it's kind of wonderful. And
summer is coming.
Summer is coming, and you should always be visiting Tuscanini.
Always. At least three or four ice cream cones a day. Most doctors recommend at least that.
Yeah. Now, we have some boring stuff to talk about.
Oh, yes. Only exclusive zoning. I mean, it's exciting to three people that I know, maybe.
So just to kind of set the stage, this isn't the only thing we want to talk about here tonight, but the thing is that and we talked about this to some degree with Jesse last week on the program, the city council came in, I should say the community development came back with the latest and greatest inclusionary housing study done in conjunction with a consultant that came back with some economic analysis and some recommendations for possible changes in the way the city's inclusionary zoning works. Right.
This is like the latest in a bunch of reports that have been issued by CDD and the city that I've looked at and been like, what were the questions being asked, and what problems were they trying to solve? Because the list of recommendations, some of which are laudable, but I think the glowing sort of more resonating part of the report was that our inclusionary ordinance, which you can explain,
I'll give you the basics,
is working. So
yeah. So yeah. And just so you're aware, the thing is the city did pass at the time was kind of groundbreaking.
Yes, it was called cutting edge in the report.
Right, 1998, I believe it was the year of passage. They changed the zoning to not just to permit the idea of inclusionary zoning, which is a certain number of affordable housing units, whatever affordable means. That's a whole other conversation. For housing developments over and above 10 units.
Right, exactly.
And the idea was that if you are going to build such a project, it's not a choice. At this point, you know, you can't take advantage of the law in order to build, you must build inclusionary units. Now, obviously, you know, the government can't just sort of say, here, build us these housing units, see you later.
Right.
So at the time, the way the logic worked, and it may be different, and that's something I like to understand a little bit better now.
I am an attorney. I can help you with all these kinds of problems.
There we go.
I just don't dress like one.
There we go. No, actually, I've known a few. So the idea was at the time that they would mandate a kind of a nominal rate of 15% affordable units on top of whatever project you were going to build. So if you were to build, let's say, a 20-unit project, then 15% of that is 3, quote, affordable units.
Right.
Now, again, that's a whole nother discussion, what we really mean by affordable. But the thing is that you can't just say, hey, you build us these 3 units for nothing. So they would give you a so-called density bonus.
Right.
Which would enable you to build an additional 3 units, basically a one-for-one match.
Right.
And then the whatever money you made either in rental or sale based on those additional units would cover the cost. That was the logic.
Well, to educate myself, I had to go back and look at some of the reports that were done more than a decade ago, I think in 2002 when it was done, to see the sort of the reasoning behind it, and it was that they didn't want it to be a regulatory taking by requiring developers to build X amount of units without giving anything in return.
Right.
Thus, the density bonus.
Right.
I think the biggest sort of confusion has been, and CDD, your messaging is terrible, that what it actually really is and what we're supposed to yield and what we're supposed to do. You know, it's 15% inclusionary, but is it 15% of the total units of the building being built? And I think that's where the argument now is, and this is why this report's here, because people feel that developers have been gaming this this ordinance, when in reality, in the report itself, it says that it's, you know, it's created some stability and predictability in the zoning, which is really what you want.
Right. Now, the basic math of this is, by the way, and I hope I get this right, but it's my job to get the math.
You get my calculator.
Right.
Go ahead.
There we go. Basically, if you're just to give an example, if you were building a 20-unit project, the city mandates you create 3 affordable units that would, and I think affordable, this it needs to also be understood that the marketing of those units, the choice of tenants, is, I believe, taken away from the developer. It's generally done through a housing agency.
Yes, that's correct.
Right. So I always like to make a distinction here between what's affordable and housing that you have to apply to a government or quasi-government agency.
Well, the affordability scale is, you know, based on the AMI and, you know,
area mean income.
So, you know, 60,
median income.
60 and 80 and goes up to 100 and 120. And I think that the current inclusionary has done a good job of helping out people in the 80 below category.
Right. And the thing is if you were just having things like federally or state funded public housing, low income housing projects, there are strong strings attached.
Yeah.
Where, in fact, you couldn't actually make them available to more moderate and middle-income people, some of them, because those are the federal guidelines. Whereas these ones, because there's little or none, I think no federal or state money involved, it's the developer's money.
That's the beautiful thing about inclusionary. And, you know, as someone who has, you know, been talking about housing in Cambridge for a little while now, you know, the pockets of low-income units and the impoverished parts of Cambridge are all clustered with the same kinds of housing because they built their own projects like Newtown Court or Washington Elms, where you have really like one economic strata in one area of the city that nowadays is really a very wealthy city. And it seems very odd to me that in a
total segregation
progressive area that, you know, all of our poor people live here, all of our rich people live here, and they don't mix up. Inclusionary changes that
totally,
but only where you're allowed to build multi-unit dwellings.
Right.
So like in that Res A area, Brattleford, you know, Huron Ave area, you're not, or in some parts of Huron Ave are multi-family, but you're not getting as much there as you would anywhere else.
Right.
Great. Change parts of this. Make it, you know, get to where you want to get unit-wise. But if you don't start looking at the city as a whole and saying, yeah, well, we need more people in West Cambridge. We need more people, you know, in other parts where there are currently no affordable units.
Right.
That to me, this is, you know.
I always draw a parallel between parents with children in school system and housing choices because, right. You know, the thing is that, you know, if you want to do sort of a good social good, to some degree, you're taking away some choice.
Right.
So if you are a big promoter of public education, you get a little upset when somebody takes their kid out of the public school because they have the choice to send them to a private school or a charter school or whatever. When you want to advocate for the public good, you end up kind of arguing against choice. You know, same thing with housing. I mean, people, if you worked hard, you know, made your money, and you want to go and live in a suburban neighborhood, to what degree do you lose? Should you have that right or not have that right?
Well, that's
even if it goes against the public good.
So, you mentioned housing and schools at the same time, and that's really a great way to figure out why parts of the middle class in the study. Are sort of going away from the city. And if you live in an area where there's a significant amount of low-income density, you'll find that a lot of people are, they're not moving because Cambridge is unaffordable, they're moving because the school rankings are zero. That may not be the reality of the school, but if you're a new parent, you're living in the city, and you're paying the market rate, which is, you know, according to this report, $600 a square foot to live in a house, and the school rank or the schools that are within your district that you'll most likely get into are ranked, you know, or a 2 out of 10, you're going to leave. You're going to absolutely leave because you're not going to, people might be as liberal as they want to be. They might be as progressive. I am neither of these things. but when it comes to their children, they're not going to gamble. Right. So, that's part of a larger equation that you need to understand.
I always say that, no matter what the sort of overarching social good is, you should never question a parent's decisions regarding their children. Oh, well, I mean, maybe some decisions, but
my son's getting a traditional Republican upbringing.
There we go.
All right.
Well, actually, let me just finish one statement about the math of the inclusionary zoning. As boring as it may be, the idea here is that if you have a 15% requirement, so on a 20-unit project, that means you have to build 3 units, but then you get another 3, so that's 26. If you do the math and then take 3 out of 26, it ends up giving you a net percentage of a little more than 11.5%.
Right.
So when everybody talks, if you in the future you hear people talking about inclusionary zoning, what's to come in the coming months? You need to understand the distinction between sort of the nominal rate, which is currently 15%, which becomes a net rate of 11.5%, versus what's proposed.
And for the people crying foul about this, I can kind of understand where they're coming from. If you say you have a 15% inclusionary ordinance, I think the layperson assumes that means 15% of the housing on that site is going to be affordable.
Right.
When the reality, and again, CDD and the city, really, this is a messaging issue, explaining how this works, why it works, and that if you take a base amount of units and you add a requirement for inclusionary, and then you add the density bonus, the total is always going to be less than the percentage that you originally asked for.
That's
always.
Right.
It's not a trick.
It's like in baseball, if you increase the number of at-bats, the batting average has to go down.
I mean, in college I took math for people who will never do math again. So I understand this. Everyone else should be able to understand it as well.
All right, that's good. Now, so just so you understand where we're going, in addition to some of the other changes that were proposed, they are proposing not a change to the nominal rate from 15% to whatever, but in the net rate they're targeting the net rate, which is now around 11.5%. They want to bump that to about 20%.
Right.
They say it's somewhere between 17 and 20, but I think politically, the most of the rhetoric will probably
push 20. What's going to happen. So it's become predictable. It'll become a 2017 stump speech saying, this is a social justice issue. This is an imperative. We must change it to 20%. It's not even enough. We need to go to 30% and give developers nothing because they make so much money and they cut that money sack.
I'll see your 20 and raise it to 35. Oh, yeah.
Just so you know, most of those developers are actually making money through pension funds that subsidize their projects. So if you have a pension plan, you might want to kiss a developer someday.
I'm not going there, Patrick.
Yeah, right.
All right, so anyway, the proposal is to have the net rate go to somewhere perhaps pushing 20%, which means that the nominal rate would most likely then jump from about the current 15% to probably more in the vicinity of 25% in order to yield that net 20%.
Right, but there will be no increase in, I think the recommendation that there'd be no increase in the density bonus.
Which is what confused me. Now, you have some explanation of that, because the original logic was you needed forever to pay for the one additional affordable unit. You give the developer the right to build one additional market unit, and that covers the cost.
So in
it's apparently different now.
In basic, non-legally binding, I'm not representing any of you as an attorney kind of way, you're talking about a regulatory taking versus a taking outright, and you know, the Supreme Court has really not spoken too much about regulatory takings, and I think the last case that was brought before them that they denied to look at was a rent control issue, and the hinging factor on whether or not it's a taking has to be whether or not it's a complete diminution of value, or you brought it down to zero. You're actually taking the person's land in a
lot. Complete taking.
Yes. So where you've got a density bonus of 30% already built in, I think it's kind of difficult to make the argument that you've taken all value away from the project.
Right. Yeah.
I don't think it closes the door on it. I just don't think that.
So there's really kind of multi-level issues here. Like Vice Mayor McGovern has repeatedly used phrasings to the tune of, we're going to push them or hold their feet to the fire or, you know, put their head in a vise or whatever
what
other
does
metaphor
that
he's
mean?
Using to try and squeeze as much, quote, community benefit in the form of affordable units out of the developers.
So I really like Mark McGovern. I think he's a great city councilor, and I think he's done a lot of good for the city, and he's one of the more reasonable people that I've spoken to. You know, I think he comes from a social worker perspective, not as a developer or a zoning expert. Right. I think he comes at it from more, you know, understanding that he's old Cambridge, like legitimate old Cambridge, and he's, you know, he sees people leaving the city after rent control. He wants to figure out how to keep more people in Cambridge.
Right.
And I used to think that the city council didn't care at all about the middle class. And I used to be louder than I am now. And I think the reality is they just don't have the tools and don't know how to help the middle class right now. And I think this bump, which may help the 15% affordable component that they have maintained, and in the report says hasn't gone away since it's been put in place, you're going to still wind up kicking more middle-class people out of Cambridge inadvertently.
Yeah, actually, I saw on one of the listservs there was some discussion about this where basically it was likened to saying that even though inclusionary zoning does a better job than some of the other programs in terms of helping more people in the middle.
Right.
The net effect still is that you have more units, more housing, more costs go up for the higher income people, and you're making accommodation for people at the other end of the spectrum, but you still have this hollowing out.
You're just trying to squeeze the lemon that much tighter, but you're not giving me a bigger lemon to use. So
exactly.
It's the same amount of juice.
Yeah. And one of the points I've made, I did a video at some of these Envision Cambridge workshops, which will yield to a whole big process soon enough, is that focusing exclusively on housing, new housing and the affordability that's of the type where you have to apply to an agency to access.
Right.
Isn't really the whole picture. I mean, and again, I'm not trying to put myself up there on the pedestal here, but the thing is there are a few landlords in this city who still don't charge the kind of rents that the community development department seems to think
incredibly good point
is the only thing being, you know, is the only thing out there. I mean, I used to say if you want an apartment, you can look in the Boston Globe ads and see, you know, $3,000 a month, or you can go down to St. Anthony's and talk to some people, and you probably find yourself an apartment. But, you know, there is this whole nother kind of...
I have discovered in my limited time being here, about a little more than a decade working here, that the city staff, I love you guys, kind of, and the councilors as a whole don't really consider small developers or small property owners as being anyone who can really, they want to engage with, or they think they can actually help the situation out. And I think it's really a missed opportunity. You're a landlord, I'm a landlord, both of us I know don't charge market rents.
Right.
But we do this. We have our own math. I have my own math on a pro forma that
it works
look
for
at
me.
Projects, and it works exactly right.
It works for me.
But when I see numbers from CDD that says a one-bedroom is $2,583, A two-bedroom apartment is $2,950, and a three-bedroom apartment is $3,400. I have to laugh, because that is not real. That's maybe what you're getting from, you know, from Forest City. Maybe that's what you're getting from the larger developers. Yeah. But these are not the majority of the housing in Cambridge, because you can't. It's very difficult to poll these owners. I understand that.
Right. People would be very, if they ask me, hey, we'd like you to put down on paper officially what you charge or don't charge. You know, a lot of people are going to be resistant to that.
They actually do that.
Right. They do that? Well, I've never answered one of those.
Well, you know, they do that polling, but I bet a lot of people are reticent to submit it. Primarily because they fear that their assessment's going to go through the roof.
Yeah.
You know, that narrative right there, I think, creates the possibility to reach out to those property owners and say, if you have housing that you're not charging market rate for, let's try to work with you to keep it that way through a tax subsidy system or some way to make it so it's not a city out of pocket, it's not a landlord out of pocket, but you still get to do the right thing and you still have control. Right. Because as anyone knows, and I'll say it again, I'm only going to say it three times, but rent control was about control. And when you take things away from property owners, they're going to get pissed.
Yeah. I actually remember that when I was a candidate back in 1993.
Can I say that on TV?
Okay. So back in 1993, I remember I was you know, being a math geeky kind of guy. I was trying to, you know, when rent control was very controversial. But then, you know, question 9 happened only a year later, and wiped it out. But, you know, I was trying to kind of, in a nerdy kind of way, come up with some sort of formulaic way of making it more reasonable for small property owners. And I was sort of laying out this sort of plans. And then a woman at one of these house parties says, "You don't understand at all." And she says, "It's not just the money. Right. You know, it's the fact that we have no say. We have no choice. It's about the control." So I get that. I understand
that. It's very difficult. I think what we just talked about, whether, you know, landlords like us, we are the majority. And I know we are. I speak to landlords all the time. There's not one of them out there that I know that does what I would consider to be the market rate thing.
There are a few,
and they're loud and they're proud. You've got Mr. Madden on Columbia Street. I said his name out loud.
He's up. Yeah.
Please, I'm afraid of nobody. But, you know, there are people who do that because, but do you blame him or do you blame the guy who sold the building for $8.9
million? Right.
And now you got to make your mortgage based on what you just paid. Granted, maybe you shouldn't pay that much and, you know, caveat emptor, but like, that's the math.
Yeah. And things definitely race out of control. Now, what are some other aspects of this inclusionary zoning, the new proposal? One proposal is right now is the minimum threshold were for projects of 10 units or more. Mm-hmm. They are talking at least some possibility that it'll drop it maybe to 6 units or more.
That's what was used in the examples, which I thought was kind of curious, because right now it's...
But 10. They haven't explicitly said that.
Right, exactly.
Yeah.
But why else would they map out a 6-unit building? I think they're trying to show what the threshold might be as far as down as they can go, and 6 being the, in their mind, the threshold. But that's, you know, a very important part. And actually, if you look at how they gauged what was feasible, it's based on a return of equity. It's based on what they call a capitalization rate, which is essentially your return on your investment in the property. And they used a four.
Which I have no idea what that means.
So it's just,
I know what the number 4
that's
is.
That's saying that you're willing to go in and buy a property and get 4% return on your investment. Now, why in God's green earth would you ever do that? The only person I know that does that on a regular basis lives in Newton. I won't say his name out loud, but it rhymes with fan. And he buys everything at a 4 cap or lower.
Right.
And he's buying everything.
Yeah.
Radio Shack. But, you know, for the average investor, no one's going to accept a 4% of return on their investment. That's completely ludicrous.
Right.
And a terrible number to use. I mean, I think 5 is my threshold personally, but I'm, a medium class buyer. But, you know, for any person who's starting out, like, I didn't look at anything that was less than a 6 or a 7. That to me makes no sense at all. You got to have that return.
So I think, I don't know if this is completely indicative of what's to come, but I personally think that this proposal that arrived 8 days ago We'll probably get hashed out. I think there's three scheduled meetings of the housing committee where people from all sides will come in and discuss it. And all of that is before it even makes its way over to an ordinance committee, because ultimately this would be an ordinance change, the change in the zoning ordinance. So this is not going to end right away. This is not something that's going to get rocketed through. It definitely needs some discussion.
It needs some discussion. I think that one other aspect they really need to think about is, how does this tilt commercial development? How does it tilt the pendulum towards commercial development versus residential? And if you look at a place like Central Square, which I will keep talking about forever, right now it's much more lucrative to build commercial than it is residential. In fact, the tax vis-a-vis the inclusion area is much greater than any linkage fee even Councillor Mazin could imagine. Calling you out.
Yeah.
But you know, is that the narrative you really want to send to developers? Do you want to say, yes, $600,000, which is what the city manager said in affordable unit costs, is the tax per unit we want to put on residential development? Meanwhile, and that's under the current inclusionary, for commercial, I pay $15 per square foot. I can build a lab in my building, kick Toscanini's these out, make a fortune, and live in Boca.
This kind of relates to some degree. We actually got about a minute left here in this program, this half hour.
Sorry.
Vice Mayor McGovern, he's talked about pushing the developers to do this, but not so much that they walk away. Now, there's two different kinds of ways of walking away. One is you just say, well, screw it, I'm not going to do anything. Another way is you say, as long as I still have the right to build commercial or lab, whatever, that's just what I'm going to do, and I don't need to hassle. Trying to play that fiddle so carefully is...
By right projects still exist, my friends. It means they don't have to talk to you.
Right, yeah. So, anyway, I think it's going to be some interesting discussions to follow. So, we're down to our last 30 seconds.
Oh, my God, what shall we do with the 30 seconds?
I don't know.
Talk
30
more.
Whole seconds. Right. Well, anyway, we'll come back in for the next half hour. We'll talk a little bit more about some of the multifamily.
Can we talk about Central Square?
And we'll talk about some Central Square, which is the place we love dearly here. So, we are now sitting, actually. So, anyway, having said that, this has been another exciting half hour of Cambridge Inside Out.